Welcome to the OnFit podcast.
Hello and welcome to the OnFit podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. I'm Emma McGarthy, head of OnFit Sustainable Policy Institute, and today we will be discussing integrating ESG into investment frameworks and decision-making processes. I am joined today by Dr. Xing Jia, who is ESG investment strategist at in the APAC region at State Street Global Advisors. So welcome, Xing, and thank you for joining us today. So let's dive in. I think my first question to you will be, what are the main methods and tools investors use when integrating ESG factors into their investment decisions?
Thank you, Emma. It's a great question to start with, I think. It's kind of laying the foundation to what we do in this area. So when we're talking about methods and tools, there are some key ones that investors are using, including negative screening and best-in-class / positive screening, ESG integration, impact investing, and active ownership. So if we're looking at negative screening, that's probably one of the oldest method investor has been using for a very long time. Started with faith-based investors or ethical investors, if you like, mainly focusing on aligning investments with their ethical beliefs and values. So traditional sectors been excluded, including alcohol, gambling, human rights violations. Surprise, surprise, you know, dated back a long time ago with that kind of exclusions. And also recently, it has been really picked up by mainstream leading ESG investors as well, in terms of I think traditionally it was mainly from, you know, whether it's carve out sector, whether it might be sacrificing return, but the common way of using it actually across a broader spectrum, it could be return related, it could be reputational risk related, and it could be values driven as well. So they are kind of used for a lot of reasons with negative screening. So I guess an example would be it is actually common for investors to exclude, for example, tobacco and controversial weapons, based on, one or a couple or a few of these reasons, I just said. And another method kind of really gaining quite a bit of interest among mainstream investors, ESG investing is actually ESG integration. So that kind of, I think, more developed in the past decade or so, really driven by investors looking at material ESG factors and how it could actually affecting the financial returns for the longer term. Having said that, they are kind of a tricky way, because some people saying they integrate ESG into the investment process, but you do have to look very closely into what they actually do, whether it's really or they're just paying lip service and nothing have changed the investment process, or whether they do look through the investee companies, gathering the data, coming up with a proprietary research to actually driving the integration side of it. I guess another trend to note is that, traditionally it might be one type of investor just focusing on one kind of approach. Nowadays, you could argue that all investors using all these kind of approaches in one way or the other, and in combination probably with, one might be having a, bigger dose on negative screening, but the other one might be focusing on ESG integration, but they all kind of widely used by investors. And And another, I guess, observation is with the innovation in the space, even within a particular investment product or investment strategy, all these methods actually can be utilized to actually drive the alignment with investors' goals and philosophies, if you like. Another thing I'd like to mention before I hand it back to you for the next question is within the approach we are talking about, there is these active ownership practices, which it's kind of really gaining momentum among long-term investors, mm-hmm. because as universal owners, they own part of the economy. So they actually, the key thing is to engage with MSD companies to improve their ESG practices to ultimately drive changes across the economy and help with long-term value creation. So I guess this kind of coming back to the sort of the saying of the rising tides lifting all boats.
No, that, I think that's really interesting. And divestment versus kind of active ownership is something that we've been exploring a little bit as well. I'm interested about the ESG integration elements, and I wonder if you could tell me kind of, or give me an example of some of the strategies or kind of the tools and how investors have been kind of implementing that. Like how is ESG being integrated into strategies and frameworks for financial institutions?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of tools investors have been using. Probably one of the key ones that has gathered a bit of traction is actually using ESG ratings. That kind of helped to drive the development in the ESG rating space as well. So I think it used to be really a very narrow industry of, you know, providing ESG ratings. And now if you look at the market, it's probably more than 100 ESG rating providers. But I guess the challenge is actually with the rating, especially with the, there are a few, probably say 4 to 5 major rating providers. But the challenge is actually there's very low correlation between the different amount of different ratings provided by these rating agencies. So, for example, if you could have a portfolio, a two portfolio, you know, say both using, say, best in class ESG approach, which means, you know, they select the best ESG rated companies to be included in the portfolio. If you use different ESG ratings, you might come up with very different, you know, companies in the portfolio. So it is a big challenge for investors. And from our perspective, we realize this is the challenge, but we also want to help investors to overcome that. So we've decided to actually work out our own proprietary ESG rating, which is called the R Factor. It's kind of well known in the market. And so basically we started with, you know, all we're talking about this, the reason we want to integrating ESG is because for the financial material ESG factors, we want to incorporate that into the investment process. So based on that principle, we actually start with looking at a, you know, the market recognized, you know, standard setting, market recognized standards. So there is a standard setting organization called Sustainable Accounting Standards Board, so SASB. So SASB has a framework to guide ESG along the materiality line. So it's called a materiality map or materiality framework, which basically is our starting point. And we also engage with quite a few market leading ESG data providers, and in linking with the, you know, what is material for different sectors, and also utilize our own quantitative modeling. So to actually coming up with this proprietary ESG rating, which is our R factor. So I think I sort of said that lightly, but the process itself, it's actually quite rigorous, and we've done the back testing, and we've consulted with industry leaders on the methodology as well. So it is very rigorous. And we actually use R factor across our portfolios in terms of, you know, with our ESG integration approach.
That's really interesting. I think one of the other things that I wanted to touch upon a little bit today is obviously kind of when you're looking at integrating ESG, and especially integrating it into decision-making processes, physical and transition risk needs to be integrated much more into this, and into investors' kind of considerations in terms of risk. So how should this be managed, and what metrics and targets should be used to assess and manage the relevant sustainability related risks that we're now kind of seeing?
There are quite a variety range of ESG factors in play. But, you know, if someone asks me to pick a key one, and I'll definitely say it's climate change, because it is widely recognized, you know, by the investment world, you know, by regulators as the systemic risk, as a financial material risk. And, you know, and it's really reflecting the physical risk and, you know, transition risk, you know, related to that. So I guess, you know, with the flood, the fire, you know, the drought happening, and there is, it really posed the physical risk to investments. And an example of physical risk will be the 2011 flood in Thailand. Not only the most important thing, I guess, it's really it cost so many lives in that flood, and in addition to that, it actually severely damaged the supply chain. So there is evidence that just give you a number there, like 400 Japanese companies actually, because of flood, suspended their operations or lowered their output. So it is actually quite material financial as well to investments. And the transitional risk, I guess an example would be stranded asset risk. So with the, you know, that kind of, you know, there's a popular phrase called unburnable carbon. So it's really with the fossil fuel reserves, you know, a lot of them actually, for whatever the investee companies owns, you know, fossil fuel reserves, you know, this is actually posed a really serious risk to the portfolio as well. So with that, I think with people recognizing the importance of managing climate financial risk, it really goes to the back, you know, the old saying of gets measured gets managed. So it's, you know, we all seen that leading up to COP26 with governments, companies, investors committing to net zero target. So that's really a good starting point. And by the way, we have also in April last year, we have also become a signatory of the Net Asset Manager Initiative as well. So that's a starting point, I think, to actually set a target. But I guess that's a long-term target, you know, because the target's to 2050, net zero by 2050, you know, that's a long-term target. So in order to achieve that long-term target, you know, of course, you know, interim targets needs to be set. And also, to be able to measure, you know, we need those tools and metrics to help us. So one of the tools I think a lot of investors has been using for a while is carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we all know that carbon footprint suffers, you know, it's a backlog, suffers limitations, you know, such as it is backward looking, and it's probably lagging because you wait for the report to coming out, you look at that, you do your analysis. By the time you have the data, it might be already 2 years old. But there are other data to help supplement that, including green revenue, brown revenue, and fossil fuel reserve. And there's also now data set to help look at how the portfolio is actually adapted, you know, the adaptation score of the portfolio to climate change. Like this is all kind of a target portfolio, but on top of that, I think investors also started setting a target for their active ownership, like engagement targets. So it also helps with driving companies to get on a journey to transitioning to a low carbon economy, because at the end of the day, it is the ESG companies, you know, once they make a difference, you know, like, you know, the portfolio is actually easier for investors to construct a portfolio as well here.
Yeah. One of the things that we're actually seeing a little bit in our research at OMFIS and within SBI is this concept of kind of the missing middle, and the idea that kind of obviously we're setting targets for 2050, but there aren't necessarily kind of short and medium term targets being effectively set, which kind of, you know, drives accountability for kind of people who are in the roles now, and ensure that this kind of change and transition actually begins to happen kind of now in, you know, by 2025, 2030, to then start, you know, change towards 2050. Is this something that you're seeing? Do you think there are more targets being set now? Is that something that you're kind of seeing within the sector? Or do you think there are kind of targets that are now being set and managed? What are your thoughts?
I think in general, investors are grappling with, and including ESG companies as well, grappling with setting interim targets. Mm. It is definitely falling into that, you know, kind of category of easy set than done, yeah. Because it is it could involve a lot of factors in terms of how to set a credible target and to actually it's not just empty promises, because and also I think to actually drive real change within the investment supply chain as well. So definitely we see the target setting are coming. So even with our research, we actually surveyed 300 investors globally mid last year. So the report actually came out towards the end of last year to gauge investors' interest on target setting and actions taken. So clearly investors are on board and thinking along the line of if we want to tackle climate change, you know, target setting is the first step. And also following that will be actions they need to take in order to achieve interim targets. So it is definitely happening.
Yeah, that's pretty good. You touched a little bit on working with data providers, and you started talking a little bit about some of the data issues that you're currently seeing. And that's something that I definitely like to explore. So kind of what are the main information and data points that are lacking or missing in order to kind of conduct or, you know, rely on robust ESG analysis? And maybe that also ties a little bit into targeting, that you need the data to be able to set effective targets. How can this issue be overcome? And I'm kind of, yeah, what are the main data points that are lacking or missing, and how can this be managed?
Well, you sort of chatted a little bit about earlier in terms of, the ESG data side, in terms of the lack of correlation among major data providers. Mm-hmm. So, and also, I think in addition to that, there are other data probably missing in terms of, when we're talking about, for example, the carbon data, really depending on the sector, some of the risk is actually, it's down the supply chain. So, currently I think there are mainly, scope one, scope two data available. Scope three might be estimated data. So really to actually get the data part right, it's probably, I guess, not an easy task, to say the least. Yeah. And also on another, from another angle, so, we've been talking about the E side a lot, from the S side, with some modern slavery risk, investors are starting looking at modern slavery risk very closely. And in their portfolios, often they find that really the modern slavery risk are deep in the supply chain. So again, there's another area data might be missing. But I think there is a sort of, I think, favorite phrase in the industry, we shouldn't let perfect get into the way of, progress.
Yeah.
Because we all know there are challenges, but we also know that we're all working on this together. So I think, even facing these challenges, I think a lot of investors actually soldier on, keep exploring and keep engaging. Yeah. With companies to actually drive, more comparable data disclosure and standardization across the same industry. So we can actually compare apple with apples.
Yeah, that is a very common phrase, isn't it? We can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And it is true. Yeah, great. So another thing that I wanted to touch upon is the challenges when transitioning investment portfolios. And you mentioned supply chain. So I think that's a huge challenge in terms of transitioning and setting targets and managing, especially if you're looking at scope three emissions. So how should supply chains ESG be managed in terms of kind of transitioning your portfolios? What are the key challenges there?
Yeah, I think we've discussed about the challenges, investors are facing. But I suppose, if we could take a step back, look at, to transition a portfolio, it's kind of coming back to the broader, even to the broader, fund philosophy. For each different fund, they might have different investment philosophy guiding, their investment approach, day in, day out. So the key thing, actually, the data bit is actually the practical side of it. But in terms of transition portfolio, really to, in terms of having a board, having the investment committee, understanding what's happening in the industry, having their support in terms of setting the risk management framework, investment management framework, to be able to integrating all this into the ESG risk or climate risk, or even there's opportunity side to that as well, not just risk. So into the fund thinking and into the asset allocation and into investment strategies, as well as the portfolio side of it, for example, portfolio construction as well. So there are a lot of moving parts in that. But I guess if I could talk pragmatically about, in terms of once there is blessing from the top, started to look at the portfolio. So the pragmatic thing could be challenging is to look at the tracking error budget, you know, like in terms of when you transition portfolio, how likely it will deviate from the benchmark. I guess pleasingly, when we surveyed investors globally, we found that a lot of investors actually on board, like in terms of they either willing to increase the tracking error budget, like if they have a like aim to invest align certain benchmark, or they're actually willing to change the benchmark, for example, change it to a low carbon index to actually, you know, helping the whole economy to transition.
How do you think return can still be optimized whilst kind of factoring in all of these different things, integrating more kind of risk structures and
I think it is a great question, and it is also quite in line with what a lot of investors are thinking as well. And in fact, we have been working with investors in terms of trying to come up with a holy grail of optimizing return and take all these factors into consideration. For example, you know, I mentioned those factors earlier, like in terms of you could optimize on the, you know, reduce the carbon footprint, and but you also look at from other angles, like the green revenue, increase green revenue, reduce brown revenue, and you know, reduce exposure to fossil fuel reserves, and have a very good adaptation score of the portfolio. So all these can be actually optimized with a very benchmark aware strategy. So it is kind of innovative solutions. A lot of investors are thinking along those lines as well.
No, that's really great. And I guess kind of tying into this slightly is looking at the role of green investment products and labels. So what developments have you seen there? What role are they playing in this transition? And a key question, I guess, is how can greenwashing be avoided, kind of especially looking at these products and these labels?
In terms of, because investors are very keen to pushing along the ESG integration journey. So there are a lot of products coming out, trying to meet the demand of investors. But there are also a lot of them probably not doing what they say they're going to help investors achieve. So, and investors are well aware of that. Well, on the other side of that is actually regulators are noticing the trend as well and introducing regulations. I think in Europe, that's that sustainable finance disclosure regulation, the SFDR, and also in Asia, you know, there's Hong Kong and Taiwan are looking at kind of similar regulation, and in Australia, where I am based, Australian Securities Investor Commission, ASIC, is also sort of started cracking down on investors actually with their green investment products. You know, if they have a bit of a concern of greenwashing, you know, they're actually going to explore further on that. So it is definitely a big concern for the industry as well, to because ESG at the end of the day, everyone wants to look at that to actually help managing material financial risk and opportunities. So it can't become such a I guess a machine to generate hot air, but not really achieving the aim as it should be. So I think the key things in terms of how it can be sort of avoided in a way is to one, having a product to actually make sure label it correctly, first of all. So the so-called tool to label. And then secondly, investor education is very important. So, you know, as we're talking to investors, like all the time, you know, I really want to make sure they understand, our product and what they can and cannot achieve.
Yeah.
And then I guess, a third and the last one, probably the main thing is to actually have proper reporting to really, inform investors of the social, you know, environmental impact it can generate.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we're running out of time, but thank you so much for taking the time to join our podcast today. It was a really insightful conversation, and really great to hear that kind of these steps are being taken, and you know, all of these things are kind of being considered about in the investment community. So thank you very much, and thank you for listening. You can subscribe to this and all other OnFIF podcasts on our channel, on Spotify and iTunes.
Thank you for listening to the OnFIF podcast.